Greetings and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. Our show tonight continues that investigation. That is Islamic law relevant to today's modern world? But we will focus this time on international law. This is because there are about 56 states with Muslim majorities or having significant Muslim minority populations among the world community of nations. The fact that Islamic states had been major players on the international scene is also very important in considering this issue. We also find today that there are many non-Muslim states and governments willing to acknowledge and allow the practice of Islamic personal law. But nobody talks about international Islamic law as if it does not exist or that it absolutely has no relevance to our times. If Islamic law does not have an international dimension, one can truly say that Islamic law is not relevant to all aspects of human life, for the international dimension is an essential aspect of our lives on this planet. So, does Islamic international law exist? Does Islamic law have an international dimension? Is it relevant to our time? Is there any evidence of the role of Islamic law and its development in the contemporary international arena? To help us find answers to these questions, we are pleased to have on our show Sheikh Abdul Qadir Mubarak, graduate student of the Qom Seminary and doctoral student in international law at the University of Tehran. Sheikh Abdul Qadir, welcome to Minbar.
Thank you very much.
I understand you are one of the more senior scholars from Nigeria who have been studying in the Qom Seminary and also in the University of Tehran.
Yeah, of course.
Now, to go right into the subject, is there something called Islamic international law?
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. First of all, I will thank you for inviting me to this program. And also, I'm very happy that this program is being actually focused to international law for this time, and more especially concerning the role of the international law in this time that we are now living, in this modern time. Actually, concerning this question, whether there is something called Islamic international law or not, there are different views about this issue among the international law scholars. Some of the scholars are of the view that definitely we have something called Islamic international law. But some of them say, no, we can just say we have international law compared to Islam. So we can just not say Islamic international law, we can just say Islam and international law, which means just in comparison between the two together.
So this assumes that there's something called international law.
Yeah.
And there's something called Islam.
Yeah.
You know, you compare international law to Islam.
Yeah.
I see.
So those who are saying that there is Islamic international law, they are trying to take the issue of the relationship between the first Islamic government during the time of the Prophet of Islam with the other nations, or the relationship between Muslims and the non-Muslims from the beginning of the Islamic preaching when the Prophet of Islam was in Mecca, even before he migrated to Medina. The Islamic international law, which those people or those part of the scholars have been mentioning, is that now when we look at the time of the Prophet when he was in Mecca, there was something which was called Bay'atul Aqaba, or the Treaty of Aqaba. And the Treaty of Aqaba is when the two tribes of Medina came to the Prophet of Islam in Mecca, and they demanded him to come to Medina and then actually to settle in Medina and also to settle the disputes between the two tribes of Aus and Khazraj at that time. So some people, they say this is the first international treaty that was made in Islam. But many scholars argue this because they said at that time even there was nothing called Islamic government at that time. It was not even established.
Right.
The Prophet was didn't even establish an Islamic community or Islamic government in Medina. So
you have a point, I think.
So yeah, so actually but almost most of the scholars who accepted that there was international Islamic law, they just prove it with some conditions of what some of the scholars have written. Some books about the life history of the Prophet and the life history of the Khulafa after the Prophet. They have a kitab, a book, which they called it Kitabu Siyar. This Kitabu Siyar means the book of actually happenings which has happened during the time of the Prophet, or the life history of the Prophet and his Khulafa after him. And another book which was written and established the Islamic international law was the book of, they call it the book of, Ilmul Magazi, they used to call it, the knowledge of wars, the wars fought by the Prophet of Islam, and also those who came after him, the Khulafa. So in most cases, we can say, if we just look into the issue of Islamic international law, we can actually say that Islam has a legal system. And the legal system which is in Islam is unique. That means you cannot divide the system of Islam into two, like what we are now seeing in the Western legal system of law. Now
dividing it into two,
like the domestic law and the international law.
I see.
Which this division, some scholars they say it started from the olden Greek time, you know, the olden Greek civilization, when the people, the Greek at the time, the Greek laws or those actually legal system of the olden Greek time, they divided the system into two. They have domestic laws governing them within themselves or internally, and they were having other rules and principles, legal rules, which make them to have relationship with other nations.
Right. So you're saying
non-Greek nations.
So you're saying Islamic law is integrated.
It's integrated.
It would have both a domestic element and a foreign element.
Yes, because you see the Islamic legal system focus on one issue, which is very important here. It is just on oneness of God. And the oneness of God is the source of every legal system in Islam. Which means now if we look even the sources of Islamic legal system, first is the Quran. So if we look, we cannot divide the Islamic legal system into something called international and something called domestic. And it is what can I say, general form, you understand? Completely Islamic law is looking into the whole generation, the universe. Laws from God to add to everybody, to all the universe.
Right.
And now, if, for example, God revealed such rules through his prophet, and this revelation constitutes a rule, so we cannot just say this is just internal, only for the Islamic community in Medina. And it cannot go beyond that.
Or universal. Now, the ordinary Muslim, right, has no idea that there is a possibility, at least, of something called Islamic international law. When you think about the international situations, international circumstances, many of them do not know what is the Islamic position would be on that. You know, let's say, for example, America was an Islamic country, right, an Islamic state. what would be the position of America with respect to, you know, things like mineral rights, international mineral rights, borders, you know, things like that? Is Islamic law alive and well? And if not, what has led to the decline of the role of Islamic law in international relations?
More especially nowadays that the world members of the world community have accepted the international law to be something which everybody can use it to defend his right. And this, I'm talking either is Islamic country or non-Islamic country. Islamic law, we can use it internationally, according to some scholars, within the Islamic states. And that's why even for the definition of Islamic international law, some of the scholars, they are saying it is a sort of Islamic state, foreign legal system of Islamic states. Or we can just put it in another way, as a certain rules which shows the foreign relationship of Islamic countries. So now, if we want to use this internationally, the issue is here, we'll come here that by using this term, Islamic international law, we definitely are trying to say that we are bringing a system of law that all the world should accept it as a law and use it. You understand? And this is very important to know that in this issue, one very important fact is here, which is here, is that now the Khilafat of Islam, which was reigning before, during the time of the Prophet and after the Prophet also, and to the time of the Ottoman Empire, when from that time to today, the nations are divided into borders, and now we just talk about countries.
Right.
And in different countries, we can find Islamic legal system in some countries, and in some countries, we cannot find Islamic legal system. But we can get Muslims living in this country. That's why most of the scholars, most especially those who have written something which is called political jurisprudence, and this, they have divided Islamic countries of the world, or the world itself, they have divided into two. They have divided it that we can get something which is called Darul Harb,
right,
and we can get Darul Islam. So if we have Darul Islam, so they are saying this Darul Islam, and what is Darul Islam? They say Darul Islam, it just focus on the ideology of certain people who are Muslims. Ideologically, they are Muslims, and they accept Islam and they practice Islam, even though within themselves, within the nations they are living, within the Islamic countries, they have non-Muslims living together with them.
Right.
But the majority are Muslims. So if we find such countries, we call it Darul Islam. You understand?
Right.
So here, they can have one legal system together, and they can have one law that governs them together. Because they follow one criteria, they have one ideology, and they actually are part and parcel of one community, which is called Muslim community.
Right.
We have another, or the second part, which is Darul Harb. And this Darul Harb, which is the home of what we can say war, is not actually Islamic. Countries, which you can, it is possible you can get some Muslim, few Muslims living in this country, but majority of them are non-Muslims. And ideologically, they don't belong to Islam and they don't believe in Islam even. So they say that we, when we divide it into two, we divide this into two together, we can say this country, or the countries which are Darul Harb, they can have their own legal system internationally to govern them, the relationship between them.
Right.
And the Islamic countries also, they can have their own legal system to govern them between themselves.
Right.
But if we are talking about a legal system or international law that can govern the whole nations together, be it Darul Harb or Darul Kufr, even some they use it Darul Kufr or Darul Harb. So if we can have international law which can govern the whole world together, we just, according to the present day international law, the modern international law today, it is only based on treaties.
Mm-hmm.
And treaties, we have treaties in Islam also, according to Islamic law, but now we just talk about treaties. Now, internationally, how can you come together and put Islamic values and Islamic law and ask all the people of the world to come and follow?
Is that possible? I don't think that's possible.
So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that's why some of the scholars are saying it is very difficult to have something called Islamic international law.
Right.
Because when you are talking about international law, you are just talking about the whole world to come and follow one legal system.
Yeah, well, you know, while I was thinking about Islamic international law, it occurred to me that this could mean rules by which Muslims could govern themselves or seek their interests on an international forum, on an international relations, you know? Mm-hmm. For example, I'm a Muslim, you're not a Muslim, you know? I come to the table to do some type of dealings with you, treaties and that, and so forth. My principles could educate me in how I deal with you, rather than, for example, international Islamic law being something that is that should govern everyone. You know, at the same time we're saying this, right, we do have an idea of secular international law that is applicable to everyone. We do have this type of attitude, you know, but I think it has to be based upon conquest and domination. Right now we are under the domination of the West. You know, and the West could impose that type of international law upon us. But within this context, the separation of the world between Darul Islam and Darul Harb, all right, the abode of Islam or the abode of peace and the abode of war or harb, would this division be an appropriate term to use in modern society when we take into consideration the fact that in the time this type of nomenclature was invented or brought up, people identified themselves on the basis of religion, you know, and opposed each other on the basis of religion. You know, now we have a situation where, for example, lots of people don't identify themselves with religion, you know, and Muslim countries can have allies among non-Muslims, right? And be competing with Muslims, you know. So is this division, in your opinion, appropriate for today's time? What does war mean? Is war symbolic? You know, does it mean actual warfare or does it mean competition? What's your opinion?
Well, actually, nowadays, in this modern time that now we are living in, it's very difficult to have this division. But if women, by saying Darul Harb, we mean actually countries which should be at war with the Islamic countries, or we can wage war against them. It doesn't mean this. Even those scholars, I think from the beginning when it was said, or those who have written books even about Darul Harb and Darul Islam, there were some things which they were having in mind. Within the Darul Harb itself, we can find Muslims, even according to some of the ulama, some of the scholars, they say even those countries which are Darul Harb or Darul Kufr, they call them, you can get pure Muslims living in that country, in those countries. But those Muslims are free to practice their religion.
Right.
They are minority, but they are free to practice their religion. So they say even this country, this type of country, we can call it Darul Islam.
Ah.
So in this, It doesn't mean that when we have majority non-Muslim, non-Muslim majority in a certain country, so that is the only way that we just call this country Darul Harb or Darul Kufr.
We have to break. And we'll be back after this news break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. And we have as our guest Sheikh Abdul Qadir Mubarak from Nigeria, doctoral student in Islamic law and a scholar from the Hawza Ilmiya Qom. And we're talking about Islamic law, international Islamic law. Is there such a thing? Could Islam educate and guide Muslims in terms of their international relationships with nations of the world? And Mr. Mubarak, you were talking about a better concept of the idea of Darul Harb, or the realm or abode of war. Because some people look at this division and say, oh, Islam is a very hostile religion to the rest of the world. Yani, meaning that it separates the world between the abode of Muslims and the rest of the world as the abode of war. But you have brought a very interesting understanding to this. It is not the case. It is the case, the abode of war are those countries or peoples that are hostile to Islam, not necessarily Muslims. And there are a lot of good people out there who are not Muslims, who are not hostile to Islam. And therefore, they are considered to be, I guess, in a sort of a metaphorical sense, Darul Islam. Would you want to elaborate some more on this?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, as I was saying, some of the scholars of international law, they have this view. That when we say Darul Kufr or Darul Harb, it doesn't mean any country which is not an Islamic country or where we cannot find the majority of Muslims to be staying there or living there, so we can just term it to be Darul Harb or Darul Kufr. Actually, we, as I said, if we can find some pure Muslims, even few Muslims living in a country, let's say, for example, 90% of the people in this country are non-Muslims, but 10% are Muslims, or less than that. But they are free to practice their religion. So according to the scholars, this country also can be termed to be Islamic or Darul Islam. It can be Darul Islam, so Islamic home. By Darul Islam means Islamic home. It doesn't mean everybody should be Muslims, but he has the right to practice his religion.
And a peaceful relationship
between
the non-Muslims and the Muslims of that area.
Yeah, of course.
And maybe this is why, for example, one can explain why you find members of the OIC, some members of the OIC, being countries that have a minority Muslim population, but these Muslims in that particular country are free to practice their religion.
And of course, and even members of the OIC, some of them are not Islamic countries, you know.
Right.
And they come and participate in all the meetings of the OIC, and they participate, and they are actually free to come and participate. Even the members of the OIC, they come together not on country or on a Islamic Sharia basis, that only those countries which are practicing Islamic laws must be members.
I see.
It's not like that.
Right.
So actually, Islam is not hostile, or more especially the Islamic legal system is not in such a way that it's so rigid to just go against those who are not Muslims or who don't come together with Islam.
Now, countries like the OIC, for example, and sorry, not countries, but organizations like the OIC and other Islamic coalitions and so on, to what extent are they effective in promoting the rights and interests of Muslims on the international scene?
They have a role to play, actually. The OIC, as the only international Islamic organization, as we can call it to be, or intergovernmental Islamic organization, if it works according to the principles which are actually based upon it and is established upon that principles, it has a lot to do. Even in enacting some rules in their own countries, because majority of them are Muslim countries, and in following the real Islamic laws and the real Islamic teachings, to show to the non-Islamic countries how and what Islam really is and how Islam wants the relationship between nations to be. And this can constitute such kind of interrelationship between the Islamic countries and non-Islamic countries, and the international law is originally just trying to make, to do what? To govern the relationship between nations.
Right.
So the Islam or Islamic nation or Islamic country or the OAC itself can play a vital role in implementing this kind
of... But do they play a vital role?
Unfortunately, we cannot say that they do it. Mm. Unfortunately. Because, you see, nowadays, as we are just looking at OIC, we, the Muslims, we just look at it, or the real, actually, perception of the reality of what the organization should be according to its own statute is not what the Muslims are now witnessing. To protect the Islamic values and to propagate the real teaching of Islam as it is, and also to try to defend the right of Muslims worldwide, unfortunately, it's not what we are witnessing from the OIC. All what we can just find is that really they have meetings in different countries, they just sit together, talk together, and they just issue a communique, which we just can hear and listen, that is just a repetition of what had been said before. You understand?
Yeah.
And that's why actually we just focus and just see and look into OIC as an organization by name representing Islamic countries or is representing Islamic governments, because it's intergovernmental organization.
Right.
But it's not actually practicing or doing what it's supposed to do. Because now Islam has a very good legal system. And the legal system of Islam must be known worldwide. And OIC is in the position, to do such kind of things. It has a representation even in the United Nations and in other international organizations. We can see OIC in different meetings of the United Nations. So OIC can actually try to work more than what it is doing now. For example, now if you see what is going on in some countries, like the issue of Palestine, even if to say OIC can interfere, and it is the real interference of OIC, it can solve the issue.
Right. So why doesn't it perform its job?
Actually,
I mean, what is the main hindrance to its performing its ideal function?
We can not just take one issue and say this is the purpose or this is the main hindrance,
right,
and why, but we can just see that the OIC itself, from the beginning, and I think, was not formed on a concrete foundation. Because if you want to work, and according to the teaching of Islam, and just to defend the interests of Muslims worldwide, you have to actually base all what you want to do according to the teachings of the Quran. You understand?
Yeah. So why
and also, the problem is that I think, many scholars also have this view, the OIC itself is at the hand of the Western powers.
Oh.
So it is being tele-guided of all what it should supposed to do. So it's not free to do or to do whatever they think is right Islamically. This is the view of most of the scholars, right, even most of actually international law scholars, especially
like
the
term.
Muslims.
That's a very interesting term, teleguided.
Yeah,
guided
actually.
From afar.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So this is the problem. So if you have this problem, the Muslims are waiting to see something different from OIC.
Right.
not to just be looking and be seeing of what is going on nowadays.
Now, because, you know, international bodies are very important, and they have a very important function in the development and the practice, the enforcement of Islamic law, of international law, you know. And this is why I brought up the OIC in terms of it as an international body and, you know, and finding out its role in the propagation of Islam and using Islamic principles on the international scene. Now, what about non-Islamic organizations? For example, the UN. Do these organizations show cultural sensitivities to the different countries that are part of these coalitions? For example, does the UN show any kind of cultural sensitivity or understanding with respect to Muslim culture, Muslim customs, Muslim law? Does it try to incorporate Muslim law in its considerations with respect to its relations with Islamic countries?
Of course, if we look at the United Nations, the charter of the United Nations itself, if you read the purpose, the chapter 1 of the United Nations Charter, we can see the purpose of even establishing the United Nations itself. When you just look at it, and you just compare it with the Islamic teachings, we can see there is compatibility between the two.
Between the UN Charter
yeah.
and Islamic yeah. teachings, yes.
According to the purpose, yeah. uh-huh. I'm just talking about the purpose.
The purpose,
especially
okay.
the chapter 1 of the United uh-huh. Nations Charter, it talk about the purpose of the United Nations, you understand? To make the world peace and security, to provide security and peace worldwide.
Right.
And to make the economical relationship and such good relationship between nations, and see that all disputes between nations should be settled peacefully. This is the teaching of Islam.
Mm.
And we have this in Islam even before the creation of United Nations. United Nations was created in 1945. Islam was there in the 6th century, you understand? And then all these teachings, we are there in the Quran. So in terms of this, United Nations, according to the purpose of the United Nations, which was made, which is mentioned in the Charter of the United Nations, we can say that actually we don't just talk about what is being done now or maybe some powers, some superpowers, they are actually working sometime against the purpose of the United Nations sometime. For their own personal purposes, for their own personal interests, you understand? We just talk about the charter and what the charter is trying to focus upon, you understand? So if we are just trying to look at these, we can definitely say that, yes, of course, the culture of the Muslims or the whatever we can term it to be Islamic, and we just compared with the United Nations Charter, the organization is trying to see that there is not any difference between nations or between the different races of the world. And even more especially, if we talk about religion, not any difference in religion. And because that is why in the charter it is mentioned there is no discrimination of race, sex, and whatever you can think of in the this charter of the United Nations and the work of the those people, those who sit down and make the United
but
Nations.
But don't
charter.
These, for example, the issue of women. You find that, for example, these organizations, including the UN, tend to take a very pro-Western type of attitude towards women and apply it to the Muslim world. Not just to the Muslim world, but to basically any culture that has a different attitude or viewpoint towards women. Couldn't we say that, for example, the UN and many of these organizations, to a certain extent, at least, tend to sort of reflect Western biases and prejudices and attitudes in their policies or in their practices?
Of course, this is very clear. Mm. Because if you talk about the United Nations and the formation of United Nations itself, from the beginning, it is just following, or it is based on the Western actually perception, or
right.
the Western actually culture in
right.
such a way. And who formed the United Nations? Those who were victorious out of the Second World War, and those countries, all of them, they were Western world.
Right.
And then they formed the United Nations, and they are following a certain goal, which actually at the end will come back to their own benefits.
Now, what would, like, for example, groups like the OIC, or even individual Islamic countries, are there groups doing anything to try to change this type of agenda, this type of direction? You know, for example, the OIC could act as a very important pressure group, you know, to influence the attitude of international bodies like the UN with respect to Muslim human rights, you know, from an Islamic point of view. You know, are they doing anything? Is there any country that is trying to sort of like make inroads and defend and make other people understand the Muslim point of view with respect to their own internal domestic policies?
Well, if we say there are other organizations which are doing this or can do this, of course we have some NGOs in different mm-hmm. countries. Different Islamic countries, you can find some NGOs which are even going against what OIC is doing. And they are trying to bring the reality of the real reflection of Islamic teachings
okay.
and how it can be actually worked upon in future, even though not now. And the United Nations, now they actually work with NGOs also.
All right.
So that they hear from NGOs and they benefit from the views which come from mm-hmm. different NGOs in the world. Mm-hmm. So I can say definitely, we have some Islamic organizations or some Islamic NGOs, even in different countries, even non-Islamic countries. You can find in Britain, you can find some Islamic NGOs, even non-Islamic NGOs.
Right.
Those who only work on human rights
I see.
Basis. So those also, they call for some correction, even in terms of the charter. The charter itself has some problems. We are not saying the charter of United Nations is 100% okay. It has some problems. So there is even Kofi Annan himself. I remember 2 years ago, he was trying to even say that this charter, there must be a sort of, what can I say, correction. We have to come and...
Must be amended.
Yeah, to actually look back and see. Because when the time when the charter was written and was ratified, it was that time in 1945 after the Second World War.
Right.
The situation in those times, in this olden times, is different from now.
Right.
For example, now the right of veto, which is just given to 5 countries, the 5 members of the Security Council of the United Nations. Now the situation is different.
Right.
Why only 5 countries, they have permanent membership in the United Nations Security Council? And why only 5 countries, they have the right of veto? And now the members of the United Nations, almost all the world, the nations of the world, more than 100 and something members of the United Nations. So now there's a move calling the United Nations to come and actually review the charter of the United Nations itself and increase the number of the permanent members of the Security Council also.
Mm-hmm.
And the right of veto should be also rendered to other countries. And more especially, at least 1 or 2 Islamic countries or more than that should have this right also. This also what I remember the one of the ambassadors of the Islamic countries in the United Nations, I think the ambassador of Qatar, he brought this also during one of the sessions of the United Nations Security Council's sessions. It's very important.
Right.
So, I mean, I want to say definitely there are countries and there are NGOs who are trying to see that there should be something new
right.
within the international arena.
Now, in Islamic centers of learning, You know, for example, Al-Azhar, Qom, Najaf, and these places.
Yeah.
Are there any evidence, any indication of work being carried out in terms of analyzing international relations from an Islamic point of view within these universities, these centers of learning? Are there any moves whereby, for example, we can find the development of at least some kind of renaissance of Islamic law in this contemporary world?
Actually, so you want to take us back to the medieval era where there should be a new renaissance.
This not only today, even now, like right now. Are there people working on this type of
actually,
thing?
Is there
any development in this regard?
Well, actually, if you talk about the universities in the Islamic countries like Al-Azhar or in the Islamic seminaries in different Islamic countries, we cannot see that kind of move from the students or from even the lecturers or the professors in these universities, a move which is known and is very active to make such kind of relationship. And that's one reason behind it. One of the reasons is this, that when we talk about relationship between countries, if you just focus your relationship between Islamic countries, you will never go anywhere. Because nowadays, we have to accept what we can just call focus as a world village. It's just like a village everybody is living within it. A relationship cannot only be between Islamic countries only and leave non-Islamic countries alone.
Right.
And that's why for example, international law is not only for certain countries. And that's why some of the scholars are saying, when you say Islamic international law, even so, you are just talking about Islamic countries, and then you are taking it back to the medieval era when there was Christian international law.
I see.
You understand?
Yeah.
So if we just base our focus our points on relationship between only countries according to ideology, we will never go anywhere.
Right.
So international law, according to what we are now, the modern international law, according to what we are going, is the ideal, is the only way, and the ideal for the present world. If there is a new move from Muslims, from professors in the universities, from the students of law, from different actual universities in the Islamic country, this should be something new, and it will be welcomed. But from where to start? We have not seen it yet, and we hope that when it starts, we can be able to show to the world that Islam has the power to bring such kind of relationship between nations.
Inshallah, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
For joining us.
Thank you.
We had on our show, graced on our show with Brother Sheikh Abdul Qadir Mubarak, talking about the issue of international law. And I think we learned quite a lot today in terms of international law is really a misnomer, really. What we are really talking about when we say Muslim international law is international relations between Muslims and between Muslims and non-Muslims based upon the principles of Islam and Islamic law. This is what we're talking about. And that, for example, Islamic international law should not indicate that Islamic international law dominating other regions, but Muslims being educated and informed by their principles in their relationships and agreements and treaties with other nations. I want to thank you a lot for educating us on the and clarifying the division of the world between Darul Harb and Darul Islam. And I hope to see you again on the show sometime.
I'm at your service.
Now, anybody who has any questions, if you have any questions, any comments, if you would like us to be introduced to a local scholar who you would think might be important and useful to appear on our show, if you'd like to give us some advice, please feel free to contact us at mimbar@presstv.ir. That's mimbar@presstv.ir. This is your show, and we are dying to hear from you. We would see you again next week, same time, same place on Mimbar. Thank you very much.